Welcome to Sleepy Time Travels. Have you ever had an acquaintance that you were accidentally thrown in with because this person was attached to someone else you know? And the acquaintance was interesting, but also a little annoying? And maybe during some of the nights the three of you were drinking or whatever, you might consider him a friend, sort of, but not so much at other times? And then he or she starts attaching himself to you even when the third person is not around? Well, that's what happened to D.H. Lawrence in Italy right after World War I. Woven in with the tale of the clingy, quote, friend, unquote, are gobsmackingly beautiful descriptions of the scenes of this true tale, titled The End of a Friend. My name is Russell Stamets. Some people like to fall asleep to the audiobooks I narrate. Most of these texts come from the treasure trove of dusty, forgotten, multi-library-filling volumes worth of the public domain. If you'd like to hear more of the books I sample on the podcast, or check out the rest of my catalog, search Russell Stamets on Audible or iTunes. I'll include links to the audiobooks and the Kindle and print editions in the episode description. If this is something you enjoy listening to, besides buying the books, you can support me by rating the podcast, following, or subscribing. Now, it's time to get comfortable, settle back, relax, and listen. On a dark, wet, winter evening in November 1919, I arrived in Florence, having just got back to Italy for the first time since 1914. My wife was in Germany, gone to see her mother, also for the first time since that fatal year, 1914. We were poor. Who was going to bother to publish me and to pay for my writings in 1918 and 1919? I landed in Italy with £9 in my pocket, and about £12 lying in the bank in London. Nothing more. My wife, I hoped, would arrive in Florence with £2 or £3 remaining. We should have to go very softly if we were to house ourselves in Italy for the winter. But after the desperate weariness of the war, one could not bother. So I had written to N.D. to get me a cheap room somewhere in Florence and to leave a note at Cook's. I deposited my bit of luggage at the station and walked to Cook's in the Via Tornabuoni. Florence was strange to me, seemed grim and dark and rather awful on the cold November evening. There was a note from Dee, who has never left me in the lurch. I went down the Lung Arno to the address he gave. I had just passed the end of the Ponte Vecchio and was watching the first lights of evening and the last light of day on the swollen river as I walked, when I heard Dee's voice. "Isn't that Lawrence? Why, of course it is. Of course it is. Beard and all. Well, how are you, eh? You got my note? Well now, my dear boy, you just go on to the Cavalletti. Straight ahead, straight ahead. You've got the number. There is a room for you there. We shall be there in half an hour. Oh, let me introduce you to M." I had unconsciously seen the two men approaching, D, tall and portly, the other man rather short and strutting. They were both buttoned up in their overcoats, and both had rather curly little hats, but D was decidedly shabby and a gentleman, with his wicked red face and tufted eyebrows. The other man was almost smart, all in gray, and he looked at first sight like an actor-manager, common. There was a touch of down-on-his-luck about him, too. He looked at me, buttoned up in my old thick overcoat, and with my beard bushy and raggy, because of my horror of entering a strange barber's shop, and he greeted me in a rather fastidious voice, and a little patronizingly. I forgot to say I was carrying a small handbag, but I realized at once that I ought, in this little gray sparrow man's eyes. He stuck his front out tubbily, like a bird, and his legs seemed to perch behind him, as a bird's do. And I ought to be in a cab, but I wasn't. He eyed me in that shrewd and rather impertinent way of the world of actor-managers, cosmopolitan, knocking shabbily round the world. He looked a man of about 40, spruce and youngish in his deportment, very pink-faced and very clean, very natty, very alert, like a sparrow painted to resemble a tomtit. He was just the kind of man I had never met, little smart man of the shabby world, very much on the spot, don't you know. How much does it cost? I asked D, meaning the room. Oh, my dear fellow, a trifle, 10 francs a day, third rate, 10th rate, but not bad at the price. Pension terms, of course, everything included, except wine. Oh no, not at all bad for the money, said M. Well now, shall we be moving? You want the post office, D? His voice was precise and a little mincing, and it had an odd high squeak. I do, said D. Well then, come down here. M turned to a dark little alley. Not at all, said D. We turned down by the bridge. This is quicker, said M. He had a twang rather than an accent in his speech, not definitely American. He knew all the shortcuts of Florence. Afterwards, I found that he knew all the shortcuts in all the big towns of Europe. I went on to the Cavallotti and waited in an awful plush and gilt drawing room, and was given at last a cup of weird, muddy brown slush called tea, and a bit of weird brown mush called jam on some bits of bread. Then I was taken to my room. It was far off, on the third floor of the big, ancient, deserted Florentine house. There I had a big and lonely, stone comfortless room looking onto the river. Fortunately, it was not very cold inside, and I didn't care. The adventure of being back in Florence again after the years of war made one indifferent. After an hour or so, someone tapped. It was Dee coming in with his grandiose air, now a bit shabby, but still very courtly. Why, here you are, miles and miles from human habitation. I told her to put you on the second floor, where we are. What does she mean by it? Ring that bell, ring it. No, said I, I'm all right here. What? Cried D. In this Spitsbergen? Where's that bell? Don't ring it, said I, who have a horror of chambermaids and explanations. Not ring it? Well, you're a man, you are. Come on, then. Come on down to my room. Come on. Have you had some tea? Filthy muck they call tea here. I never drink it. I went down to Dee's room on the lower floor. It was a littered mass of books and typewriter and papers. Dee was just finishing his novel. M was resting on the bed in his shirt sleeves, a tubby, fresh-faced little man in a suit of gray, faced cloth-bound at the edges with gray silk braid. He had little blue eyes, tired underneath, and crisp, curly, dark brown hair, just gray at the temples. But everything was neat and even finicking about his person. Sit down, said Dee, wheeling up a chair. Have a whiskey? Whiskey, said I. 24 francs a bottle, and a find at that, moaned Dee. I must tell that the exchange was then about 45 lire to the pound. Oh, N, said M, I didn't tell you. I was offered a bottle of 1913 black and white for 28 lire. Did you buy it? No, it's your turn to buy a bottle. 28 francs, my dear fellow, said D, cocking up his eyebrows. I shall have to starve myself to do it. Oh, no, you won't. You'll eat here just the same, said M. Yes, and I'm starved to death. Starved to death by the muck, the absolute muck they call food here. I can't face 28 francs, my dear chap. Can't be done, on my honor. Well, look here, N, we'll both buy a bottle. And you can get the one at 22, and I'll buy the one at 28. So it always was. M indulged D, and spoilt him in every way. And, of course, D wasn't grateful. Au contraire, and M's pale blue, smallish round eyes, in his cockatoo pink face, would harden to indignation occasionally. The room was dreadful. Dee never opened the windows, didn't believe in opening windows. He believed that a certain amount of nitrogen, I should say a great amount, is beneficial. The queer smell of a bedroom which is slept in, worked in, lived in, smoked in, and in which men drink their whiskies, was something new to me. But I didn't care. One had got away from the war. We drank our whiskies before dinner. M was rather yellow under the eyes and irritable. Even his pink, fattish face went yellowish. "Look here," said D. "Didn't you say there was a turkey for dinner?" "What? Have you been to the kitchen to see what they're doing to it?" "Yes," said M, testily. "I forced them to prepare it, to roast." "With chestnuts, stuffed with chestnuts," said D. "They said so," said M. "Oh, but go down and see that they're doing it. Yes, you've got to keep your eye on them, got to. The most awful howlers if you don't. You go now and see what they're up to." D used his most irresistible grand manner. "It's too late," persisted M, testy. "It's never too late. You just run down and absolutely prevent them from boiling that bird in the old soup water," said D. "If you need force, fetch me." M went. He was a great epicure and knew how things should be cooked. But of course his eruptions into the kitchen roused considerable resentment, and he was getting quaky. However, he went. He came back to say the turkey was being roasted, but without chestnuts. "What did I tell you?" cried D. "They are absolute. If you don't hold them by the neck while they peel the chestnuts, they'll stuff the bird with old boots to save themselves trouble. Of course you should have gone down sooner, M." Dinner was always late, so the whiskey was usually two whiskeys. Then we went down and were merry in spite of all things. That is, D always grumbled about the food. There was one unfortunate youth who was boots and porter and waiter and all. He brought the big dish to D, and D always poked and pushed among the portions, and grumbled frantically, sotto voce, in Italian, to the youth Beppo, getting into a nervous frenzy. Then M called the waiter to himself, picked the nicest bits off the dish, and gave them to D, then helped himself. The food was not good, but with D it was an obsession. With the waiter, he was terrible. "I don't drink this dirty water. What's that in it? A piece of fish clout? Oh, holy Dio! I can't eat another thing this evening." And he yelled for more bread, bread being war rations and very limited in supply. So M, in nervous distress, gave him his piece. And D threw the crouted part on the floor, anywhere, and called for another liter. We always drank heavy, dark red wine at 3 francs a liter. D drank 2/3. M drank least. He loved his liquors and did not care for wine. We were noisy and unabashed at table. The old Danish ladies at the other end of the room, and the rather impecunious young Duca and family not far off, were not supposed to understand English. The Italians rather liked the noise, and the young signorina with the high-up yellow hair eyed us with profound interest. On we sailed, gay and noisy, D telling witty anecdotes and grumbling wildly and only half whimsically about the food. We sat on till most people had finished, then went up to more whiskey, one more perhaps, in M's room. When I came down in the morning, I was called into M's room. He was like a little pontiff in a blue kimono-shaped dressing gown with a broad border of reddish purple. The blue was a soft mid-blue, the material a dull silk. So he minced about in demi-toilette. His room was very clean and neat and slightly perfumed with essences. On his dressing table stood many cut glass bottles and silver-topped bottles with essences and pomades and powders and heaven knows what. A very elegant little prayer book lay by his bed, and a life of Saint Benedict. For M was a Roman Catholic convert. All he had was expensive and finicking, thick leather, silver-studded suitcases standing near the wall. Trouser stretcher all nice. Hairbrushes and clothesbrush with old ivory blacks. I wondered over him and his niceties and little pomposities. He was a new bird to me. For he wasn't at all just the common person he looked. He was queer and sensitive as a woman would be, and patient and fastidious. And yet he was common. His very accent was common, and Dee despised him. And M rather despised me because I did not spend money. I paid for a third of the wine we drank at dinner, and bought the third bottle of whiskey we had during M's stay. After all, he only stayed 3 days. But I would not spend for myself. I had no money to spend, since I knew I must live and my wife must live. "Oh," said M, "why, that's the very time to spend money, when you've got none. If you've got none, why try to save it? That's been my philosophy all my life. When you've got no money, you may just as well spend it. If you've got a good deal, that's the time to look after it." Then he laughed his queer little laugh, rather squeaky. These were his exact words. "Precisely," said Dee. "Spend when you've nothing to spend, my boy. Spend hard, then." "No," said I. "If I can help it, I will never let myself be penniless while I live. I mistrust the world too much." "But if you're going to live in fear of the world," said M, "what's the good of living at all? Might as well die." I think I give his words almost verbatim. He had a certain impatience of me and of my presence. Yet we had some jolly times, mostly in one or other of their bedrooms, drinking a whiskey and talking. We drank a bottle a day. I had very little, preferring the wine at lunch and dinner, which seemed delicious after the war famine. Dee would bring up the remains of the second liter in the evening, to go on with before the coffee came. I arrived in Florence on the Wednesday or Thursday evening, I think Thursday. M was due to leave for Rome on the Saturday. I asked Dee who M was. "Oh, you never know what he's at. He was manager for Isadora Duncan for a long time. Knows all the capitals of Europe. St. Petersburg, Moscow, Tiflis, Constantinople, Berlin, Paris. Knows them as you and I know Florence. He's been mostly in that line. Theatrical. Then a journalist. He edited the Roman Review till the war killed it. Oh, a many-sided sort of fellow." "But how do you know him?" said I. "I met him in Capri years and years ago. Oh, 16 years ago. And clean forgot all about him till somebody came to me one day in Rome and asked, 'You're N.D.' I didn't know who he was. But he'd never forgotten me. Seems to be smitten by me, somehow or other. All the better for me, ha ha. If you like to run around for me. My dear fellow, I wouldn't prevent him if it amuses him. Not for worlds." And that was how it was. M ran D's errands. Forced the other man to go to the tailor, to the dentist, was almost a guardian angel to him. "Look here," cried D. "I can't go to that damned tailor. Let the thing wait. I can't go." "Oh, yes. Now look here, N. If you don't get it done now, while I'm here, you'll never get it done. I made the appointment for 3 o'clock. "To hell with you. Details, details. I can't stand it, I tell you." Dee chafed and kicked, but went. "A fussy little fellow," he said. "Oh, yes, fussing about like a woman. Fussy, you know. Fussy. I can't stand these fussy." And Dee went off into improprieties. Well, M ran round and arranged Dee's affairs and settled his little bills and was so benevolent and so impatient and nettled at the ungrateful way in which the benevolence was accepted. And Dee despised him all the time as a little busybody and an inferior. And I there between them just wondered. It seemed to me M would get very irritable and nervous at midday and before dinner. Yellow round the eyes and played out. He wanted his whiskey. He was tired after running around on 1,000 errands and quests, which I never understood. He always took his morning coffee at dawn, and was out to early Mass and pushing his affairs before 8 o'clock in the morning. But what his affairs were, I still do not know. Mass is all I am certain of. However, it was his birthday on the Sunday, and Dee would not let him go. He had once said he would give a dinner for his birthday, and this he was not allowed to forget. It seemed to me M rather wanted to get out of it, but Dee was determined to have that dinner. "You aren't going before you've given us that hair. Don't you imagine it, my boy. I've got the smell of that hair in my imagination, and I've damned well got to set my teeth in it. Don't you imagine you're going without having produced that hair." So poor M, rather a victim, had to consent. We discussed what we should eat. It was decided the hair should have truffles, and a dish of champignons, and cauliflower, and a zabaione, and I forgot what else. It was to be on Saturday evening, and M would leave on Sunday for Rome. Early on the Saturday morning, he went out, with the first daylight, to the old market to get the hair and the mushrooms. He went himself because he was a connoisseur. On the Saturday afternoon, Dee took me wandering around to buy a birthday present. "I shall have to buy him something. Have to, he said fretfully. He only wanted to spend about 5 francs. We trailed over to the Ponte Vecchio, looking at the jewelers' booths there. It was before the foreigners had come back, and things were still rather dusty and almost at pre-war prices. But we could see nothing for 5 francs except the little saint medals. Dee wanted to buy one of those. It seemed to me infradige. So at last, coming down to the Mercato Nuovo, we saw little bowls of Volterra marble, a natural amber color, for 4 francs. "Look, buy one of those," I said to Dee, "and he can put his pins or studs or any trifle in as he needs." So we went in and bought one of the little bowls of Volterra marble. M seemed so touched and pleased with the gift. "Thank you 1,000 times, N," he said. "That's charming. That's exactly what I want." The dinner was quite a success, and poorly fed as we were at the pension, we stuffed ourselves tight on the mushrooms and the hare and the zamboioni, and drank ourselves tight with the good red wine, which swung in its straw flask in the silver swing on the table. A flask has 2.25 liters. We were 4 persons, and we drank almost 2 flasks. Dee made the waiter measure the remaining 0.5 liter and take it off the bill. But good food, and cost about 12 francs a head, the whole dinner. Well, next day was nothing but bags and suitcases in M's room, and the misery of departure with luggage. He went on the midnight train to Rome, first class. "I always travel first class," he said, "and I always shall, while I can buy the ticket. Why should I go second? It's beastly enough to travel at all." "My dear fellow, I came up 3rd the last time I came from Rome," said Dee. "Oh, not bad, not bad. Damned fatiguing journey, anyhow." So the little outsider was gone, and I was rather glad. I don't think he liked me. Yet one day he said to me at table, "How lovely your hair is. Such a lovely color. What do you dye it with?" I laughed, thinking he was laughing too. But no, he meant it. "It's got no particular color at all," I said, "so I couldn't dye it that." "It's a lovely color," he said. And I think he didn't believe me that I didn't dye it. It puzzled me, and it puzzles me still. But he was gone. Dee moved into M's room and asked me to come down to the room he himself was vacating, but I preferred to stay upstairs. M was a fervent Catholic, taking the religion, alas, rather unctuously. He had entered the church only a few years before, but he had a bishop for a godfather and seemed to be very intimate with the upper clergy. He was very pleased and proud because he was a constant guest at the famous old monastery south of Rome. He talked of becoming a monk in that aristocratic and well-bred order. But he had not even begun his theological studies, or any studies of any sort. And Dee said he only chose the Benedictines because they lived better than any of the others. But I had said to M that when my wife came and we moved south. I would like to visit the monastery sometime, if I might. Certainly, he said. Come when I am there. I shall be there in about a month's time. Do come. Do be sure and come. It's a wonderful place. Oh, wonderful. It will make a great impression on you. Do come. Do come. And I will tell Don Bernardo, who is my greatest friend, and who is guest master, about you, so that if you wish to go when I am not there, write to Don Bernardo. But do come when I am there. My wife and I were due to go into the mountains south of Rome and stay there some months. Then I was to visit the big noble monastery that stands on a bluff hill like a fortress, crowning a great precipice above the little town and the plain between the mountains. But it was so icy cold and snowy among the mountains, it was unbearable. We fled south again, to Naples and to Capri. Passing, I saw the monastery crouching there above, world famous, but it was impossible to call then. I wrote and told M of my move. In Capri, I had an answer from him. It had a wistful tone, and I don't know what made me think that he was in trouble, in monetary difficulty. But I felt it acutely, a kind of appeal. Yet he said nothing direct. And he wrote from an expensive hotel in Anzio, on the sea near Rome. At the moment, I had just received £20, unexpected and joyful from America. A gift, too. I hesitated for some time because I felt unsure. Yet the curious appeal came out of the letter, though nothing was said. And I felt also I owed M that dinner, and I didn't want to owe him anything, since he despised me a little for being careful. So partly out of revenge, perhaps, and partly because I felt the strange wistfulness of him appealing to me, I sent him £5, saying perhaps I was mistaken in imagining him very hard up, but if so, he wasn't to be offended. It is strange to me even now how I knew he was appealing to me, because it was all as vague as I say, yet I felt it so strongly. He replied, "Your check has saved my life. Since I last saw you, I have fallen down an abyss, but I will tell you when I see you. I shall be at the monastery in 3 days. Do come, and come alone." I have forgotten to say that he was a rabid woman-hater. This was just after Christmas. I thought his "saved my life" and "fallen down an abyss" was just the American touch of very, very. I wondered what on earth the abyss could be, and I decided it must be that he had lost his money or his hopes. It seemed to me that some of his old buoyant assurance came out again in this letter, but he was now very friendly, urging me to come to the monastery and treating me with a curious little tenderness and protectiveness. He had a queer delicacy of his own, varying with a bounce and a commonness. He was a common little bounder. And then he had this curious delicacy and tenderness and wistfulness. I put off going north. I had another letter urging me, and it seemed to me that, rather assuredly, he was expecting more money, rather cockily, as if he had a right to it. And that made me not want to give him any. Besides, as my wife said, what right had I to give away the little money we had? And we were stranded in the south of Italy with no resources if once we were spent up. And I have always been determined never to come to my last shilling, if I have to reduce my spending almost to nothingness. I have always been determined to keep a few pounds between me and the world. I did not send any money, but I wanted to go to the monastery, so I wrote and said I would come for 2 days. I always remember getting up in the black dark of the January morning and making a little coffee on the spirit lamp and watching the clock, the big-faced blue old clock on the campanile in the piazza in Capri, to see I wasn't late. The electric light in the piazza lit up the face of the campanile, and we were then a stone's throw away, high in the Palazzo Ferraro, opposite the bubbly roof of the little Duomo. Strange dark winter morning, with the open sea beyond the roofs, seen through the side window, and the thin line of the lights of Naples twinkling far, far off. At 6:10, I went down the smelly, dark stone stairs of the old palazzo, out into the street. A few people were already hastening up the street to the terrace that looks over the sea to the Bay of Naples. It was dark and cold. We slid down in the funicular to the shore, then in little boats were rowed out over the dark sea to the steamer that lay there showing her lights and hooting. It was 3 long hours across the sea to Naples, with dawn coming slowly in the east, beyond Ischia, and flushing into lovely color as our steamer pottered along the coast, calling at Massa and Sorrento and Piano. I always loved hanging over the side and watching the people come out in boats from the little places of the shore that rose steep and beautiful. I loved the movement of these watery Neapolitan people and the naive, trustful way they clamber in and out of the boat, and their softness and their dark eyes. But when the steamer leaves the peninsula and begins to make a way around Vesuvius to Naples, one is already tired and cold, cold, cold in the wind that comes piercing from the snow crests away there along Italy. Cold and reduced to a kind of stony apathy by the time we come to the mole in Naples at 10 o'clock or 10:20. Still awake? If you'd like to hear more of The End of a Friend by D.H. Lawrence, just search Audible or iTunes or Amazon for the Kindle and print editions. I'll put links in the episode description. And again, please follow, subscribe, give 5 stars, or let me know in any way that you enjoyed your trip.